Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
Damon Vickers with us, the author of The Day After the Dollar Crashes, a survival guide for the rise and fall of the New World Order. He's a money manager. He's a media personality. 25-year track record of articulating investment themes with striking clarity, listen to those words, and then holding his ground as the daily barrage of market noise forces others to fail. He's been able to spot social trends and use them to play the market with. He's third generation in a financial family. His father was a floor trader for Goldman Sachs on the New York Stock Exchange. Grandfather worked at Kidder Peabody and Company subsequent to his father's career on Wall Street. And they've been at it for a long, long, long time. Damon, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you? Awesome.
Oh, good, and I'm glad you are. You know, in a time like this with the economic turndowns, let's call it, and the recession facing us, whether we're in it or not, it's time to feel awesome. I believe in my heart of hearts, and I'm not a financial guy, but there's plenty of money out there. And I think the biggest problem that we have today is the inability to forecast to see if it's going to be safe or not to put that money to work.
Well, I suppose I you know, there are some great ideas out there. There's some great, certainly public companies, but frankly, I wish there were a lot more ideas for us to invest in. I wish some of these companies that were sitting on the sidelines would be brought public so that investors could have some, you know, fresh ideas and opportunities to invest in, rather than polishing the pits of Bank America, Citigroup, Intel, Cisco, Microsoft, Texas Instruments, you know, all those types of names that are just, you know, pretty much in a downtrend for the last decade. So there are some great companies out there, and America's still great, too.
I know, by the way, yes, and I believe that to my heart of hearts. I'm an American all the way across the board. The one thing that's very scary to me, you know, and I'm sure you've been watching some of the demonstrations that are going on in Wall Street. These kids that are out there, have you heard some of the responses, some of the answers? One of the reporters will say something to the effect of, well, do you have a job? Well, no, corporations won't let me work. Well, if a corporation offered you a job, would you take it? No, they're the people who destroy jobs. So, you know, you get this going out there and you have to sit back and scratch your head and say, is this what the future is going to be?
Well, you've got you know, I don't know, maybe 500 million to maybe 500 to 700 million people globally that are getting out of colleges. They're young. They're very different than our generation or even the generation that preceded before us, in that I believe the generation that preceded before us and maybe even the one before that, they really had more trust in the system. They had more trust in the government. They had more trust in the idea of electing a Democrat or a Republican, and they cheerleaded their political party like a city might or a state might cheerlead their own football team. But the younger people of the world are far more connected and far more interested in about a relationship with one another and doing something, I think, a little bit more constructive than the fantasy of the political process, which only seems to serve the special interests. So in spite of the fact that many people think that the gatherings around the world are negative, I think they're actually extremely, extremely positive and good for the process, because discussion of our problems and discussion of our situations is certainly a good first step towards maybe hopefully beginning to find some solutions rather than putting our brains to sleep.
No, by the way, I totally 1,000% agree with you. Damon, I think where we might have a crossroad here is you've got to be, not you in the general sense of the word, you've got to be on the same page, moving in the same direction to get some kind of a connection to have conversation. When you get a group of 1,000 people and you've got probably 600 different reasons that they're there.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
it doesn't exist anywhere.
Well, I disagree. Because I don't think we have to agree. I think, and you and I don't have to agree.
Of course not.
If people get out there and they have a good, honest, earnest discussion and disagree and agree and mix it up, and these people want that, and these people want this, and these people are protecting the environment, hey, that's not a terrible thing. And these people are more about maybe a little bit more equality for children or for senior citizens, or maybe these people are for something else. We need to be talking about, maybe there's another group that says, like, hey, the political process is bought and paid for by special interests. This is ridiculous. All of these things are valid things to talk about, and they're not just talking about them here. They're talking about them in all the westernized nations across the planet. This is growing. It's growing from city to city. It's growing from country to country. And what we're moving towards is, and I feel it, as we're moving towards what will likely be the biggest single demonstration that the world has ever seen, and not even a demonstration, like an assembly of people all around the planet. It's huge, and it has nothing to do with governments. It has nothing to do with, well, I'm an Iranian. I don't even think it has anything. It doesn't have much to do with religion either. I'm a Catholic versus a Jehovah's Witness versus a Mormon versus a Baptist versus a Buddhist versus that's all of that stuff is irrelevant. I think what it has to come down to inevitably is, do we love our children? Do we love our children? Am I willing to extend that love to your child? And am I willing to extend that love to not only my child, but maybe the child of an Iranian or a German or a Jew or even an Al-Qaeda child? That really what's at stake is the future of this world and our children. We may bicker back and forth as adults, but look at what's at stake. What's at stake is the whole nut, and it's not looking good. So this is a kind of a crying out, if you will, of the problems globally. And thank God we're talking about them. It's a good process.
No, by the way, the process is good. My goodness, you and I couldn't agree any more than that. But in the process, in the strategy, the process, you don't poop on a police car. You don't answer questions that your answers have absolutely no relevance to anything going on. You don't slop a place up. You don't do drugs.
This is like you got to look at this a little bit. Now, other than you're running a radio show, I don't know you all that much. But I mean, you sound like a guy that might have. I mean, you know about the stuff that happened in the '60s. You know about those demonstrations at the colleges and all this. So I mean, you know about that stuff, right?
I was there.
Yeah, you were there. Okay, all right. So you know, I think pooping on police cars and this type of stuff, I mean, that's kind of a little bit ridiculous. But you know, look, it's variety. The essence of life is variety. It's the beauty of the world in diversity, whether you go into a rainforest and there's every different assortment, hopefully, of butterflies and little mammal creatures and birds and trees and figs. And if you go into the Caribbean, maybe you see mangoes and bananas just out in the jungle. This is the beauty and the variety of our world. So when you tell me there are people there that are quote defecating on the streets, okay, that's interesting. But there's all kinds of people there. And thank God there's all kinds of people there, and they have all kinds of issues. And what an amazing thing that no matter that they have all different ideas and, quote, agendas and things that they're demonstrating for, they're talking about it, and they're coming together. I think it's tremendously positive.
Yeah,
and,
look,
you know, for us to talk about it, you know, this is the political process. People have a right to assemble, and they have a right to thank God they do.
Yes, it's good.
This is democracy. You're witnessing democracy is alive. It's good.
Now, by the way, absolutely, yes. But the theme that I've seen so far, I've stayed on this. It's anti-capitalism. It is pro-government. It is saying government owes me a job. Government owes me school. Government owes me this. Yada, yada, yada. And they're talking anti-capitalism. Half of them have no idea what capitalism is about. Yes, there's going to be the Bernie Madoffs, and that's horrible. There is no question about that. But without some of these major corporations, there wouldn't be any jobs. Yes, there are people who take advantage of the system and make money while other people are starving. We also have a president that is out there spending millions of dollars and playing and having a great time and talking about helping the poor. So they're getting mixed messages, and that's causing confusion for them at the same time.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but you've got, as I said, you've got maybe somewhere between 500 million and 800 million people around the planet of this age group that have graduated from the colleges and the universities, that's a very big block. And they're in the West, and they've been displaced by Vietnam and China and the rest of them, and their discontent and their suffering is growing, and so they're crying out. But it's not just the young people that are crying out. It's the people that are, that you know, crying about their mortgages and about their finances, and it's people crying out about health care and the fact that they can't afford to. So there are a lot of issues here. Now, the solutions to these issues, by the way, there are solutions. It is, these problems are not unsolvable. Health in this country could be easily solved by recognizing that disease, and these are things that we talk about in our book, that disease comes from your nutrition. It comes from the elk that's rotting upstream, and that carries into the whole biosystem. We need to pull the rotting elk from the river so that we don't keep having diseased diets and wrecking our aquifers and all that kind of stuff. That's a simple problem. If you've got kids that are or young adults now that can't form sentences and are defecating on police cars, well, that's our failure as parents and as a society, really not.
Let me hold you up. Good educational system. Damon, the educational system doesn't mean anything. It's your problem, your responsibility. It's my responsibility as a parent with those kids. That's where it starts at home. But they keep yelling, right, education, education, education. If they had all the education in the world, what's the impetus? What's that incentive for them to stay in school? Look at the dropout rate. Education isn't where it's at.
You teach a kid to memorize something, or you teach a kid to love information.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to seek out their own information and educate themselves. That's a much better form of education than the type of educational system born out of the Second World War and creating factory workers and a kind of factorized educational system. A lot of the things that we teach kids are entirely worthless. They have no tangible translation into the real world. And so it's not surprising that we're falling behind. But the problem in the United States and the West is really the inability for us as a country to manufacture a finished good at a price that's globally competitive. We're going to manufacture an iPhone, there were 4 million iPhones sold in the last week or something like that. I mean, it's another multi-billion-dollar product launch of Apple Computer. And the thing was manufactured in China. It was designed here, but manufactured in China. And in the past, you know, if we had a technology that would arrive, we would create all these jobs because we would innovate, because we had a society, Michael, that encouraged the crazy person that would defecate on the police car as much as the PhD. And occasionally, you got some creativity out of that diversity, right? That's our country.
It's a good word. It's a good word. But what's wrong with creating here? What's wrong with the manufacturing plants here? What's wrong with drilling here? We have so much untapped natural resources right now that would put people to work until we moved into whatever alternative energy source that we want.
The planet needs to come into balance because we treat the planet like a piece of toilet paper. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, that's the truth.
Okay, but what about the regulations to stop everything? You know, there are ways. Well, let's look at this. Okay, I spent 23 years in Alaska. Wait. And I was up there. I was up there where they had the roads that were paved to go up to the oil drilling rigs and so on and so forth. Now, the key here is this. What did they do? They loaded them with ice so they wouldn't destroy the roads. They were very careful with the environment up there. I don't know where a lot of these stories came from, but I physically was up there and saw what was going on. I think the biggest problem is somebody – follow the money, Damon. Follow the money. Find out where it is that's blocking it and who's getting paid to do it, and I think you'll get a handle on what's going on.
Alaska is not a fair representation of the entire United States. Alaska is one of the last in an area that's in the last frontiers of the world. Alaska, British Columbia, northern Canada, up into the North Pole, and that's really the Siberia over in the Russian tundra. That's a beautiful area with a lot of biodiversity, and we've kind of really done it to the United States. I mean, we've cut down 97% of the trees. We're wrecking all our ponds and streams with all this either Roundup or fertilizers where all the ponds are choked off.
People are dying and starving in California. You can't do anything because you want to disturb the fish. I mean, you know, there's got to be this.
It's important not to disturb the fish. That's a part of preserving biodiversity on a global basis. Just as we have a respect for the person that would express himself by defecating on the police car, which I don't condone. We also need biodiversity. Very, very important for our survival as a planet. I think it's beautiful. I love that. I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau. I kind of enjoyed seeing that.
Yeah.
And I like the biodiversity of the planet. I don't go to a place like Alaska for 20 years and come out of it thinking, gee, we should have put in more roads and cut down more trees and drilled more. Because I think maybe you might have appreciated the beauty of the mountains and the snow and the salmon and all that kind of stuff. Because here down in the lower 48, it's kind of all paved. You know, they put a paved paradise and put up a parking lot and strip centers and Taco Bells and McDonald's. And it's just kind of all kind of ugliness and really not good for anybody. And it's causing health problems and disease and dissatisfaction and a general discontent globally all over the planet. So and we can't park enough RVs or enough cheeseburgers into the side of our mouth to make any of us really any happier. And it's really the failure of the Western system on a global basis. So what we're moving towards is a kind of a unified planet, and you will see the assemblies grow larger and larger until the culmination into the largest assembly that the world has ever known. And it will be the most beautiful, most profound moment that the world has ever seen. And we've all been waiting for this for a very, very long time, and it is coming, and it's on the way, and it's soon, and it's nothing to be afraid of.
No, it's not fear. We're just about running out of time, but there's a consciousness behind it that those kids have no idea what they're talking about for the most part. And Damon, with
that, they don't have to because it's at the beginning. It's the birth. It's the birth of a new global order.
Okay, and by the way, we're running out of time, and I'm going to have Radio Susie get a hold of you. We'll come back, and we'll talk more about it, and I've appreciated your time. Do you have a website we can find you at to get the book, find out more?
Go on DamonVickers.com, and I appreciate you talking about it and having me on the show. And what I'll do is for the first call 800-553-0553. I'm going to give a free autographed, signed, first cover, hardcover edition of this book for the first 25 callers. We'll call 800-553-0553. That's 800-553-0553. For the first 25 callers, so call right now and make sure they get a free autographed copy of The Day After the Dollar Crashes, a survival guide for the rise of the New World Order.
Great. Hey, Damon Vickers, thank you so much for being with us.
All the best. God bless you.
Take care. Good night.
So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona, show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Augustus McMillan with us. He runs three major services, accounting, consulting, and tax preparation. He attends annual week-long IRS tax seminars and many one-day-long seminars and online tax classes. He's a voracious reader, and as a matter of fact, he reads tax books, and he updates them annually and biannually, and he's old school, and he still receives actual print subscriptions to 14 monthly, biweekly, or weekly business publications. We're going to talk about starting and developing a small to mid-sized business. And hi, Augustus, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being here. Let me start it this way, where I think what you were talking about is probably right now is the greatest window of opportunity for starting the small to mid-sized business. Years back, we started out with the mom-and-pop stores. You walked in, they knew your name, they knew who your family was, and you were friends and so on and so forth. Big corporations came in, and mom-and-pop couldn't compete with the corporations. So mom-and-pop went out of business. Corporations were doing fine. Then the corporations started to compete with global companies that were doing what they did. They couldn't compete with them financially, so they had to outsource. When they outsourced, they let a tremendous amount of people go. Now, when that happened, those people that didn't find a job did what we do in America. They became entrepreneurs. They started their own businesses. The biggest problem is they didn't have guys like yourself to hold them by the hand and take them through and say, this is how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually get a lot of clients, potential clients, like you said, from people who get laid off, people who get severance packages and things of that nature. They get laid off, they get unemployment, they get severance packages, so they have some income to work with. Then they also had the time that's necessary to start a business. So we've been blessed and fortunate that even though that we're in a recession, or I don't really call it a recession. I mean, any time that you're in something for 3, 4, 5 years, I just say it's the current conditions of the economy, but even with this current conditions, we've actually increased our revenue every year because we've seen an increase in clients.
Yeah, and by the way, and today especially, somebody gets a good idea, you know, they can create, because the one thing that we had here in this country that they didn't have in a lot of countries was the innovation. We started things, and then the problem there was we couldn't finish them because we couldn't afford to keep up with the competition. And right, there's a tremendous amount of money out there. I still believe that, Augustus, there's a lot of money out there, but the people that have the money are afraid to let it go. I was talking about this in the this first interview we had before you came on, that they're afraid to let it go, and they're afraid to let it go because they're unsure in this economy because they don't know where anybody's going. But this is a great time to start a business.
It's such a wonderful time to start a business in. You know, you were saying about offshoring. When I started the firm and I first started looking to get help, I did some offshoring, and it's just not something that I advise. I guess you have a manufacturing type of business, it's definitely advantageous for you, but when you're dealing with services and things of nature like we do, you're going to save money with offshoring, but in the long run, I just think it's better to keep those jobs here.
Sure,
longer doing the offshoring.
Yeah, by the way, I totally agree with you as regards to that. But the idea is that there are a lot of people who do it, but at the same time, they got this great idea. They're going to jump into it. You got your computer. You got your office at home. But you also need to have some capital behind you. You've got to have enough money to be able to move through that first 6 months or so, that first year, and be able to project. Because in that very beginning, you know, there's a lot of unknowns there.
Absolutely. It's great when you know that you're going to start a business before you're ready to start it. Those are the type of people that we love to work with. If you know that you're going to start a business in a year, 6 months, maybe 2 years. For example, sometimes we may have a person that's a civil servant, like a firefighter. You know, they can retire after 20 years. So, you know, somebody who start working at 18 or 20 years old can retire at 40, 41, 45, still relatively young. Know that they want to start a business. So we get with those type of persons. And like you said, just having to save money, save money, save money. So even like you said, even when you're starting a business at home, people don't realize there's still capital expenses. You still need equipment. You still need to hire people to do things you can't do, like a website, for example. You still need to pay the fees and taxes associated with starting your business for local, state, and federal levels and things of that nature. You know, even collateral such as business cards, letterhead, you know, you still need money. You know, and like I said, if you're quitting your job or if you're not having as much income, maybe you're reducing your hours, or if you're something like unemployment where you don't have as much income, like you said, then you still need income to live off of, like you said. So you have to have capital to start a business. Even if you're starting it on a shoestring, you have to have capital.
Oh, absolutely. The other thing that you have to have is somebody who handles your bookkeeping, because you got the IRS out there, and the IRS is not sympathetic to what the problem is. You owe money, they want the money. So it's always good to know, have somebody who knows how to deal with that money to offset some of the problems that you could have at the end of the year.
Right. And I don't care. We work with companies as small as someone who wants to start a daycare in their home to up until the size of a $25 million realty development company. And what we no longer do is, if you don't want to take care of your financials, then we're not going to work with you. Like you said, you have to have your bookkeeping set up. If you don't have a system in place, then we'll implement one for you, but you have to have your bookkeeping set up. You don't have an accurate picture of where your company is if you can't print out financial statements, you can't run a report of profit and losses, if you can't see what products are profitable, what products or services aren't profitable, what are good months of the year for you, things that need to. If you don't have your financials, you really aren't in control of your business. You don't know what your business is doing. You don't know when it's a good time for you to hire seasonal employees and all that type of stuff. So if you don't have your bookkeeping and your financial system in place, we're not going to work with you. Like you said, you have to have your tax returns filed. There are, you know, we work with a lot of people, small businesses and things of that nature, who may look to get a government contract, or they may look to partner with become a vendor of a bigger corporation. And the government and these larger corporations, a lot of times they're going to ask for financial statements, and a lot of times they're going to ask for tax returns. When you're going to get a loan, the bank's going to ask for financial statements and tax returns.
Now, and by the way, well, one thing very important, because I know you absolutely deal with proper planning, there's also the business plan. The guesstimate of what it's going to take you to get to, you know, certain spots. You got a business plan, you forecast, and let's say that, you know, in 6 months you want to be making X amount of dollars. If you're not making that, then you can sit back and say, all right, what's it going to take to get to the goals that we want? If you can't forecast it, and if you don't have a business plan, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And the next thing you know, that wonderful business that you had in your mind is costing you an arm and a leg. You're going bankrupt, and you owe everybody under the sun.
Absolutely. Most of the time, people come to us with business plans when you want to get a loan, because 9 times out of 10, the bank or institutional investor, even the angel investor or private investors, is asking for a business plan. But like you said, it's just imperative to have one, period. If you have a business plan, then like you said, you have something to fall back on. You know where the company is going. But another thing about the business plan is that when someone contacts us to work with them on a business plan, we don't complete the entire business plan for them. We have them work on the business plan with us because it gets them to learn the industry. A lot of times, you know, someone may get into a business because they know that their business is profitable. They know that their business is something that may work in their geographic location. They know that their business is something that they have the capability of doing, but they still may not know the industry. So we're sitting there, we're working with them to put together this document, and they have to learn the industry. They have to do research to learn different cycles and things of that nature. So other than just having a plan to fall back on, other than just having a document to provide to someone that's giving you funding, you actually learn the industry. And then another thing is, like I said again, if, you know, a lot of people think of it just to get financing, but once again, if you're a small company and you're looking to become a vendor for IBM, or you're looking to become a vendor for General Electric, or if you're looking to get a huge federal contract, once again, other than your financials, they might look, ask for your business plan to see if, you know, where you're going with this business, what type of management team do you have in place, what type of processes do you have in place, and that type of stuff. So a business plan, really, just like your financials, really makes you look at the financial strength of your company. A business plan really makes you look at your company overall. And, you know, in a business plan, you have stuff like competitive analysis, so you can look and see how you compare to your competition and things of that nature. So a business plan is such an important tool. It's so much more than just getting you funded.
Oh, no question about it. And also, that, you know, the knowing the when and where to get assistance. I've said this for years. I do not know everything in my industry. I don't. How could I? But I have the magic. What I have is a Rolodex, and it tells me where to go, when I want something. And I think it's extremely important. You get into business, you better know when and where to get the assistance specifically that you need.
Absolutely. I think one of the best things, the second best thing we can do for our clients is, other than providing them the best service we can possible, is to be a good resource for them. For example, we don't do marketing plans and things of that nature, but a lot of businesses need marketing plans, and a lot of businesses need to get marketing done. So we have, you know, quality people that we might recommend our clients to. You know, like I said, we do a lot of taxes, so a lot of time our tax clients want us to service them, to become their client, just like they're a client of us. And if we need a particular service and stuff, of course we want to go to our clients first. But I mean, one of our tax clients sell Yellow Pages ads, and he wanted us to paste an ad in Yellow Pages. And I told him that that probably isn't the best way for us to market. Just thinking to myself, if I were thinking about spending $1,000 on a document, which is what you're doing when you're buying a business plan, am I going to look in the Yellow Pages, or am I going to ask my attorney? Am I going to ask my banker? Am I going to ask my accountant, or ask, you know, someone else who started this business? So you definitely have to, you know, have a good pipeline of sources and referrals to get the proper help you need. If your toilet breaks at 3 o'clock in the morning, you might pull up the Yellow Pages to find somebody with 24-hour plumbing repair. But, you know, something like an accountant, someone like a consultant, someone like a attorney, you're going to want referrals.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And we live in a world today that the suppliers, if you're in that kind of a business, you have no idea who you're dealing with. So there are people that the best way to do business, there are people that you ask, and if they've done business with other people, that's your best recommendation that you could possibly get. Augustus, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's MacAdvises. That's MacAdvises.com. The Baltimore number, that's our headquarters, is 410-775-6226. We also have offices in Atlanta and D.C., and anyone who calls and said that they heard us on the show, we'll give them a 10% discount.
Wonderful. Hey, Augustus, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I think your subject matter is very important, especially today in the culture that we live in. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
For you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
To call my own, I want a dream love. lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I wanna dream.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Robert Foreman is with us. He's the author of Enlightenment Is Not All It's Cracked Up to Be, A Journey of Discovery Toward Jazz in the Soul. He's uniquely qualified, both personally and professionally, to reimagine the spiritual life. A meditator for 40 years, he gained his PhD from Columbia University, specializing in religious experiences around the world, and became a tenured professor of comparative religions at City University of New York. After he retired from teaching, he helped found the Journal of Consciousness Studies and founded and still directs the Forge Institute for Spirituality and Social Change, which has developed the Soul Jazz family of programs to help people weave the depths of their spiritual discoveries into their everyday life. Robert, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Spirituality, do we really know, as a population, not for people who have studied, do people really know what spirituality is?
Oh, I don't know what people know, but I can say what I have come to understand it to mean.
Please.
Which is that many people distinguish personal experience, which is kind of autonomous, from being part of a religious system in which you are to some extent told how to think or how to feel. But there are many people who are both religious and spiritual. And I think what spirituality is pointing to is the sense of being part of something larger than yourself, the sense that something is out there more than what we are, more than what we know. It is to some extent part of us, and we are to some extent part of it, but it is something grander, something fuller than we ourselves are.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that you wake up every morning and everything is going to go the way that you want it to go during the day. I have found for years now that the best thing that can happen to us spiritually is realize when you fall down, there's a reason for falling down. And I think if you incorporate that into your everyday life, I think life becomes there's more sense to it because there is a purpose behind it. I believe people without spirituality are lost with purpose, and they can get sidetracked for all of these myriad of ads that you see, you know, join our this and you can become spiritual that, and for only $1,000 you can be a whatever. And I think people are getting moving away from that today. And spirituality is really in that quiet moment by yourself when you can really hear, and I say, when I say hear the universe, hear what's going on without all the noise.
I think what you said in the beginning of that was that people have the wrong idea about spirituality. It doesn't make your life perfect. And the reason I wrote Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be is to help people be clear on what spirituality is and isn't. In other words, there's lots of fantasies about enlightenment. There's lots of fantasies about what spirituality is. But I think what it is I think what you're pointing to is it's a path to help us become more centered, more whole, and live our lives more fully. So, yes, I agree with what you're saying, Michael.
Yeah. Now, where was it for you that you saw it, that you experienced it, that moment where there was that aha moment, Robert, that you caught it and you knew that there was something more out there?
Well, I've been meditating for about 45 years, and I think my first experience was I was driving back from a long meditation weekend. We used to call them retreats or residence courses, and I came back from this course in which we'd meditated quite a number of hours for the whole weekend. And as I drove back, I was coming back from Cape Cod, I drove past this forest of these very tall pines, and there was a sense as I was there, I got out of my car, and there was a sense of being in this forest, being in something spacious, quiet, open, and a real sense of presence to the whole thing. And I think that was kind of my clue as to what this stuff was about. And I think that's continued for me. And I think it is what spiritual people are pointing to, the sense of being part of something greater than yourselves and the sense of being open and free in the middle of your own life. I think that was the moment for me that really turned me on to it.
Yeah, I would imagine, and I'm not a clinician, but I would imagine, and if all of your experience as a psychotherapist, that most people have problems, and when they come into therapy, the reason they come into therapy is because there's a disconnect somewhere in their life. There's something they're reaching for that they can't find, and it's causing frustration, it's causing confusion, and somehow they're not connecting, and I think the biggest problem is they don't know what to connect with.
Right. And I think spirituality is not psychotherapy. You can practice meditation, you can do yoga, you can go to church, and you can still have your psychological issues. But I think what spirituality does is it gives you a sense of being present. It gives you a sense of being connected to something larger than yourself. And I think that's what can help people get through those harder times. And I know it certainly helped me when I had therapeutic issues, psychotherapeutic issues. It certainly helped me, and I know it's helped a lot of people. So it provides a kind of center to a life. So when you say that the spiritual helps people become more connected to a sense of meaning, I think that's what you're pointing to, and I think that's an important thing for folks.
Totally, and I think that sense of meaning also is something called identity. Most people today, with all the confusing messages and information that we get, Robert, they're confused as to who they are. And when that confusion starts, this lack of identity, you know, we move as a human being, we move towards something that will accept us. And if they accept us and there's a commonality and agreement of what the world is about, then all of a sudden you have this thing called identity. It may not be the best thing in the world for you, and there's where I think a lot of the confusion is, but we search for identity, and I think our true individual identity is found within our own spirituality.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I want to push that one more notch further. That is to say, to be practicing, to be doing something around your spiritual life helps you establish an identity, but it helps you feel that who you are, that identity, if you will, is connected more deeply to something larger, so that it's a sense of being grounded, so that the identity that we develop is a sense of being grounded in what is real. And I think that sense of reality, that sense of depth, and quiet presence is really what the spiritual path provides for people.
And a big confusion, something that just flew through me just now. It said, stop defining because you're never going to get it. And I'll bring you back 25, 35 years ago. I'm in Southern California. I'm laying on the beach. It's one of the most beautiful nights that I've ever seen. There's 1.5 million stars, if not 2 million stars out there. And I started thinking of what's beyond that. And my linear mind, my human linear mind, got scared because I couldn't fathom what's beyond the beyond. It had to stop somewhere, but then how could it? And what I came to was basically this, is there are things that are undefinable yet out there. And if you think you can define the undefinable, then you have no, not you, but you have no idea what you're talking about. So it's more of allowing things to happen than it is to try to get a handle and get it defined every time something happens. You know what this is? It's called get out of control. And that's where I think the true control is.
Now, that's nice. And I want to add this, Michael, and I think what you're describing is just wonderful. Imagine that you were able to live your whole life with the same sense of openness and effortlessness and presence that you felt that time in California with 1.5 million stars. There's a sense of sort of, as you're describing that, I'm feeling like what you probably felt was as if your belly was dropping down and as if the beach behind you or the land behind you was sort of opening out. And that sense of openness, that sense of presence is what the spiritual life is all about. And I think people that take up the spiritual life and are consistent with it, that's more and more the sense that begins to dawn. So I think what you're describing is very much a spiritual experience.
Yeah, see, we fear one thing. We fear the unknown. That's really what people back off. And what happened for me specifically, the fear became a strength. Once it transitioned into that, then all of a sudden, who has to know what's out there? And I think that's really where it is. It's causing the unknown to become the known, and you don't have to define it on a piece of paper.
Right, and I think this, what you're pointing to, I would describe as a comfort with the ambiguity of being alive.
Yeah.
And for me, that comfort with ambiguity or the comfort with the coincidence of opposites, I know and I don't know, that sense of comfort is really a sense of openness and freedom. And it's that freedom that the spiritual life is all about. It's that openness and the sense of being really comfortable in whatever circumstance you are. That, I think, is what people are moving towards, and I think when I hear you describing that experience.
Yeah, and that's realistically where it is. The comfort within yourself, when you become yourself, and I think that's what spirituality is, and which is a kind of a contradiction in terms, because when you become yourself, you begin to realize that you're not just yourself. But it's becoming comfortable. You're not living your life based on what somebody else thinks that you should be, causing all the problems that go along with it. You're the first best you, and if you can just stop every once in a while, quote unquote, smell the roses, it makes all the difference in the world. Just stop for a minute and smile.
Yeah. Can I read you a little passage from Enlightenment 8, what it's cracked up to be, because I think it's quite close to what you're describing?
Love it. Go ahead, sure.
May I read you a little passage?
Please, yes.
What the spiritual path offers is not unmingled happiness, and it is not the conventional, nor is it camaraderie or ease, though these may come. What you get instead is to be increasingly open to the joy and the melancholy that is the deeply lived life. In the end, you get to be increasingly alive, the mystery coursing up your spine. You get to be more awake, more deeply honest, freer, and to stand up straighter and straighter in it. You get to be, in all its ancient simplicity, homo erectus, the ability to stand up straight in this sense of what is greater than you. So I think that's pretty close to that experience you had in California.
Sure. Yeah, and it's called Allow It To, and there's so many people that are searching for something they don't know what it is they're searching for. And I really believe, and I've found this over the years, if you just get quiet, and I'm not a meditator, because I'm typical during the day, I'm roaring and I'm 10 minutes ahead and 20 minutes behind and so on and so forth. But every once in a while, I'll catch that right now minute. Every once in a while, I think it happened about 2 years ago, walking around the side of the house and it was this gorgeous flower and I just stood there for a minute and I just looked at it and allowed it to be what it was. And for that moment, I caught it. And we can catch those moments, but you got to know to look for it.
Yeah, I beg to differ, by the way. People that practice meditation, I myself practice meditation. Because you practice meditation, it doesn't mean you don't get busy. I just spend a little of my time before I get up in the morning meditating and in the evening meditating, and it's not a lot of time, but it certainly helps me be clear and present when I'm busy. So it's not like you have to be, you know, not doing anything in order to be engaged in a spiritual life.
I do it twice a day. And for me, it's just my mind goes so quick. But I do it twice. I do it in the morning, do it in the shower. And if I can get a minute of centeredness, I'm happy because it's better than nothing. Yeah. I'll do it at night before I go to bed.
Yeah. Well, I think I think that's more than most people do. And I compliment you for it.
Yeah,
I have a spot where I'm driving south. I live just north of New York City, and I have a spot that I see, the big George Washington Bridge coming south on the road. And every time I see the bridge, I say to myself, where am I in my life? So I have a little clue or a little cue that I use to help bring me to what's going on here? Where am I right now? Who am I right now? So I think that's the kind of thing you're describing, to be a little more present, a little more open.
Absolutely. There is a Radio Susie looking at me because she knows it's coming, okay, the desk. Okay, there is a they've used it a few times but to describe what we're talking about. Robert, are you anywhere near – are you sitting by a desk?
Actually, no, but what can I do?
Okay, you're sitting in a chair?
Yes.
Okay, touch the chair.
Okay.
You see, the moment you touch the chair, you brought the chair into existence. And I think that's really becoming totally and completely centered. Before you touch that chair, Robert, that chair didn't exist. It wasn't even there. And I wonder how much of our life, if you touch the people that you're around, if you touched what you're doing and became centered with it. Now, during the day, on and off, I continuously do that, even if it's for seconds. It's if you don't put your attention on it, it doesn't exist.
I gotcha. And what you're describing, and I completely agree with you, what you're describing is, can we be more present in our life? Can we be more open? Can we be more honest in our life? I think another piece of this is, if you can be truly honest with yourself and with your neighbor, with your friend, I think that sense of honesty also brings about this sense of being present. So if I know that I'm actually lying to myself about how I'm feeling or what I'm actually doing in the world, that also pulls me away. It's not only that I want to get close to the chair, but I want to be able to live my life such that I'm truly present in my life, and that means being able to be honest and open within my life. So I think that's another piece of this that you're pointing to.
Yeah, and the symbology of it. There was a movie that stayed with me. It was just a piece of the movie. What was it? It was the Tom Cruise. It was the, what was it, The Last Warrior or something like that. Did you see the movie?
The Last Samurai?
The Last Samurai, yes. And there was a part where he was standing with the Japanese leader, and he walked out, and there was a tree, and there was all these little these leaves, these white leaves, they're falling off the tree. And the guy looked at it, and he said, perfect. In that moment in time, it was, because it, what perfect is the highest form of function. It's right there. And I remember every time that something looks like that that I see, for that moment, it becomes perfect. You've got to have a symbol for that purpose to recognize it. And it doesn't matter what it is. At that moment, you'll catch it. But you got to have the image and the symbol for it. You got to know it's there.
You know, I would describe a similar sort of experience, but my word for that is openness. That is, can I be open to the environment? Can I be open when I see a sunset? Can I really let the sunset in? Can I let the tree in? I think that's the kind of thing you're pointing to. And it's certainly the kind of thing I talk about in Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be. Can we be that open in our lives? Can we be more centered and more welcoming of the world?
Yeah, and one of those things that happen when this occurs, Robert, I just think, get out of the way. And what I do is I get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it's about. It's called get out of the way. And we resist, and we're in our own way. It's nobody else. They didn't do it. It's not the world. It's not the economy. It's, if you're going to flourish, you do it no matter what's going on. That doesn't mean it's easy all the time. But just to realize that there's more than, and you can move through anything.
You know, that's I think that's exactly the point of Enlightenment 8, what it's cracked up to be. That is, that we start out thinking that life is supposed to be perfect. We start out thinking that the spiritual life is going to make us perfect. But the discovery that I've made, and the discovery I think a lot of people are making, is it doesn't make it perfect. But it does mean there's something of value in that. Even though the spiritual life doesn't make everything perfect, certainly it helps people become more centered and more true to themselves and more open, so that there's that sense of being connected to life. Even though it's not perfect, even though it's not what it's cracked up to be, still, life can be much more present. We can be much more present to our lives and much more alive in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
no, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at to buy the book?
We do. The website is called enlightenmentaint.com. That's E-I-E-N-L-I-G-H-T-E-N-M-E-N-T, Enlightenment, Aint, A-I-N-T, all one word, no apostrophe in Aint. .com, and the book is available there. And there's also, for listeners of this show, there's a free possible download of an audio chapter of the book. I think people have been really enjoying that. So I hope that people can come to it. I think this book is just the kind of thing that people that are interested in their spiritual lives really need to see this book, because it helps dispel the myths and get rid of the hype. And it allows people, it helps people get really connected to themselves in the process. So, yeah, I would encourage people to pick up the book, Enlightenment Ain't What It's Cracked Up to Be.
Wonderful. Hey, Robert Foreman, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for your time.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Jeffrey Hurton with us, MD. He is the author of The Sobering Truth, What You Don't Know Can Kill You. He's a native Californian, resides in rural San Luis Obispo with his wife, Debbie. His past as a high-functioning alcoholic, his medical expertise, and his life experience have uniquely equipped him to expose the shocking physical, psychological, and social effects of alcohol. Jeff, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Ray?
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. By the way, are you both still in San Luis Obispo?
Yes.
In 1971, I was going through from Los Angeles to San Francisco, to San Francisco, and I stopped at Hearst Castle, and I will never forget that as long as I live. San Luis Obispo in that area is absolutely gorgeous.
We think we live in paradise.
Oh, absolutely. You don't think you do live in paradise. It's great. It's wonderful. Let's start with a base, and let's talk about alcoholism. And there are many people who have heard the words alcoholism, but they may not really understand truly what it is and what causes a person to be. So let's start at the beginning. When did you realize you were an alcoholic? When did you start drinking? And when did the truth come to you that it may or could ruin your life?
I had been drinking for over 30 years on an almost social basis when I woke up one day and realized that I was drinking much heavier than I had been drinking in the past. And I'd made several failed attempts to quit and suddenly realized that I was out of control and that I couldn't quit on my own.
Now, by the way, not quitting on your own, interestingly enough, I have interviewed people that have gone through AA for many, many, many years now. And the one common denominator that went through, instead of going to the normal psychologist, the psychiatrist, etc., they had the only people that could really help them were people who have been there, done that, gone through the process, so they have a practical, hands-on expertise of how to work with this. Where did you find help from?
Well, I didn't start out in AA. I started out on my knees. In AA, we talk about a God of our understanding, and I basically got down on my knees and said that I couldn't do this alone and I needed help, and magically, with grace, I got that help.
Good. Okay. So the alcoholism, was it affecting you at home? Because I noticed that your bio said, you know, high functioning. So were you working all day long, functioning with life and your relationship, except the alcohol?
Michael Ray, my wife didn't know I had a problem.
Ah, okay.
I was a very high functioning alcoholic. I was a real stealth alcoholic. I had ways of hiding the amount that I was drinking from her, and you would never see me drunk. I would get in that kind of that sweet spot of about 0.08 of alcohol, where you feel just no worries, no cares, and I like to just stay right there. But after a number of years, that stopped working for me.
Okay, but with the, what do you call that kind of an alcoholic? There's a name for it, isn't there? Because I would venture to guess there's a tremendous amount of people. Go ahead.
Well, I think that but the term that I use is high-functioning alcoholic.
Okay, all right. Because I would imagine that there are, Jeff, a tremendous amount of people in that same position. Families don't know they have the problem. The people at work don't know they have the problem in their professions. And they end up miserable, and they can't tell anybody.
That's true. That's true. And they end up very depressed because alcohol is a depressant.
Yeah. Now, when you got the help, when you realized what was going on, how hard was it to stop drinking?
Well, from the time I finally realized, we call it the moment of truth or the moment of clarity. When I got to that point and I got down on my knees, I never had another drink.
Oh, okay.
But I couldn't do it on my own. I had tried on my own a number of times.
But what does your body go through when it changes? Obviously, I mean, you know more than anybody else, being a medical doctor, your body is basically an electrochemical factory, and it's used to function in a certain way with a certain degree of chemicals running through that body, working or not working. That had to be a heck of a change physically for you.
Yes. From years of drinking, you've established some patterns of neurotransmitters in your brain. And you basically don't have enough dopamine, which is the elation chemical in your brain. And the alcohol increases the receptors for that, so that provides it. And when you stop that, then your body is craving. That's the craving that we have, is not enough dopamine from stopping drinking.
And that basically, when you're dealing with dopamine, that's the addiction. That's not only drinking, but the people who are addicted to drugs, it's the same thing. That's, I think, is the key. Now, knowing what you knew, was there any way you could compensate? Is there any way to replace dopamine? This is a question. I'm not a clinician. Is there any way to replace the dopamine that wasn't there unless you were drinking?
The situation, the biochemical situation will straighten itself out normally if you go a certain amount of time without drinking. Those things will recorrect. So it's a matter of dealing with that craving for a period of time, and then the brain basically resets itself as far as the dopamine is concerned.
Okay. Now, the other thing that people don't realize, what you don't know is going to kill you, right, is the amount of cancers that you open yourself up to as an alcoholic.
Well, I think that's a very poorly known and poorly understood phenomenon. We're celebrating Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and there's now very strong evidence that alcohol is causative to breast cancer, and that for every ounce of alcohol a woman drinks daily, she increases her risk of breast cancer by 5%.
Wow. And
in addition to that, there's 8 other cancers that are known to be caused by alcohol.
So we open ourselves up to disease. We open ourselves up to psychological problems. We open ourselves up to, and I guess in many cases, if you didn't have that strength and got down and prayed for the help that you couldn't do by yourself, you might have, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm just listening to you, you could have committed suicide.
Well, the truth is that the cause of death in a third of alcoholics is suicide.
Hmm.
A third of all alcoholics die of suicide.
Now, by the way, when somebody needs help, when they truly need help, besides praying, where else do you go?
Well, there are lots of rehabilitation centers. Usually they're inpatient hospital situations where they can go. And basically, before you start to deal with the problem, you have to, if you've really been drinking a great deal, you have to go through detox, and you have to go through the withdrawal process. And that can be a week, 10 days of actually, there's tremendous amount, you've been suppressing your nervous system with the alcohol for such a long time. When you stop drinking, you get a reflex hyperactivity of the central nervous system. That's what delirium tremens is. People shake, people have grand mal seizures. and that has to be medically controlled until that process has run its course, which again is about 7 to 10 days.
So realistically, it's not just I'm going to stop. There's a process really to go through. That's what I'm hearing you say. There's a process to go through once you've decided to stop. And what I'm seeing here, I've got the book in front of me, by the way. I just got it about a half hour ago. What I'm seeing here, and if I look through the book, you're really talking about a guide to get yourself through this.
I think probably that, you know, I tell my story in the beginning, but I'm dealing more with the various problems that alcohol causes. We talk about all the medical issues that you and I touched on as far as cancers. There's a lot of other medical illnesses that alcohol promotes or actually causes, including osteoporosis, which is, again, one that nobody knows. Even physicians don't know that. They don't tell their patients not to drink if they have osteoporosis. And then I talk a lot about the problems with the way big alcohol markets alcohol to young people, because the huge problem that we're having now, the real epidemic, is in our teenagers. 25% of all alcoholics are teenagers.
Hmm. That's a strong number.
Well, and that believe this will even is stronger. The leading cause of death in men worldwide between 15 and 56 years of age is alcohol. 2.5 million people die worldwide every year from alcohol.
Now, by the way, when you look at also the TV ads, the movies, the rest of it, they glorify alcohol.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But they target young people, just like tobacco used to target young people, because it's very cool. It's very accepted in those peer groups. It goes along with some of the other drugs that the teenagers are using, and that's where we've got to start as far as turning the process around. Is we've got to get to the young people and let them know what they're doing to themselves.
Well, also too, the binge drinking. Let's call it, you know, the one night of drinking, and it's here in your press release. It's true. In the stories in the book, there are stories of vehicular homicides, unwanted pregnancies, other complications just for this one night where they just lose control, or somebody's forced.
Right. One moment wasted can ruin your whole life.
Yeah. No question about it. And I would imagine with kids today, they have such, quote-unquote, whatever freedom means. You know, there's so much freedom. You can't tell them what not to do. And if you do tell them what to do and you put them in a corner, quote-unquote, you're going to end up arrested even if you're the parent. So that's a real tough problem with kids, because it's very hard to get them to be responsible today and to be actually responsible for their own actions. So I can see why it's a 25% problem with them, and that's a lot of kids.
It certainly is. And it's been shown that the younger that a child begins to drink, the more likely they are to become alcoholic.
Hmm. My goodness. Now, when you really deal with this, when you go through the book, I pick the book up, I read it page by page, cover to cover. What do I, Michael Ray, get? What is my takeaway from this book once
well,
I'm done?
Basically, alcohol touches everyone's life in one way or another. For some, it's their spouse. For some, it's their sister, someone in their family. For some, it's their coworker. For some, it's their children. And there are strategies for coping. There's explanations for what's happening. And there's a lot in the book that overcomes denial for the person that really needs to re-examine their drinking habits. A lady friend read the book and she said, you know, I'm still going to drink wine, but you really made me re-examine how much I drink. And it's been really like a good look in the rearview mirror as far as where I want to go. And I'm really going to change my drinking habits.
Now, by the way, go ahead.
I had a lady, a patient, who bought the book for her son who was going away to college. And he wouldn't read it, but she left it out on the coffee table. And over a couple of weeks, she noticed that the pages had been fingered, and she was accepting that he was probably reading it. And she said to me, she said, I think every high school senior in this country should read this book. He said he won't recognize the problems now, but you've put it in his consciousness, and when he gets to college and he goes out drinking, he's going to remember those stories of waking up the next morning with a woman that he doesn't even know, and the herpes that he can get, and the venereal warts that he can get, and the woman pregnant that he can get, and that'll come back to him. And she said, I think that's really important.
Yeah, and it's true. It's true. And that moment of just losing yourself in alcohol, and if it's not alcohol, it's drugs, etc. And I think today, especially today, with everything available and open to the kids or whatever you want, quote unquote, as an adult, that it's really tough to keep this thing controlled. And I'm surprised the numbers are only where they are. We've got such confusing messages today that most people, Jeff, they're confused. They don't know which way to turn. So what are they going to do? Let's have a drink. Let's do this. Let's escape. Let's get away from it. And that in and of itself is a major problem.
That's true. There's been a tremendous increase in alcohol consumption since 9/11.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The increased stress that people feel under it, also with the economy the way it's been.
Yeah. No, I got it. Day by day by day. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at where we can get the book and get more information?
There is. The website is the title of the book. It's SoberingTruth.com, and the book is available on all the ebook sites. It's also available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it's also available on the website with free shipping.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and I think almost everybody should get this book and read it.
Thank you. Very, very appreciative, Michael Ray, of your time.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Robin Wheeler with us, the author of Born Mad. In Born Mad, she takes us on her journey of fits of rage as an angry child, blunders and setbacks as an adult, and deep denial to her quest for awareness and enlightenment. She takes you inside her deepest thoughts and fears, as well as her chronic anger and thoughts of suicide. And after being diagnosed with a bad state of mind called dysthymia, Robin wrote Born Mad to help others who may be unaware that they might be suffering from a low-grade chronic depression that will make life difficult, ruin relationships, and contribute to a negative and a hopeless outlook on life. And let us say, Robin, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. And by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, sometimes it's very hard for someone who's gone through what you've gone through to open it up and say, okay, world, here's what I went through, but you can fix it. And I think that in and of itself is really gutsy.
Thank you. Yeah, I just I didn't know what was happening to me at the time it was happening, and after I was diagnosed, I couldn't find anybody who knew what dysthymic disorder was, so I actually sat down and wrote my story in hopes of helping other people and educating other people about this kind of rare and unusual disorder.
Now, by the way, is it the symptom basically is just anger for no reason at all?
For me, it was. It doesn't necessarily have to be with other dysthymics that I know of. I actually have never met somebody else with dysthymia, but it doesn't have to be anger. There's many symptoms of it, and you could have some more prevalent than others. So just as it depends on the individual.
Now, by the way, Robin, the average doctor, if you said you were depressed, would they know to tie it into this? Is this something that most clinicians are aware of, or do you have to find a specialist who sees what it is, knows what to do, and moves you from there? It sounds like it'd be very hard to diagnose.
Yes, I actually went to a counselor for over 2 years before she recommended that I see a psychiatrist, and he was actually the one that diagnosed me. So a lot of the symptoms are symptoms that people experience every day. You know, people get frustrated every day. They get mad every day, or sometimes people have a difficult time making a decision. But that doesn't necessarily mean you have dysthymic disorder. So it can be very difficult to diagnose, and it can also be misdiagnosed as something else, like maybe bipolar.
Okay, so if you're a parent and you start to see your kids acting a little different than normally kids would act, what are some of the symptoms that you would say, okay, we need to look into this further? What are we looking for in a child?
For me, when I was a kid, it was just anger. I mean, I would let one little thing out of the day ruin my whole entire day, and then I would stay mad for days or weeks or months. So, you know, a lot of people, they get cut off on the freeway, and they just get mad for a second, and it just blows over, and then they go on, they move on with things. But sometimes people with dysthymia can't do that. They stay angry, and they exaggerate a small event and make it into a larger one or a big deal, you know, like it's a life or death situation when it's not.
Okay, now, by the way, did you ever fight with anybody? Did you ever get physical with anybody because of it?
I didn't get in fist fights when I was a kid, although I did bite other kids. I had a period of time where I just would bite anybody. I bit my sister several times. I bit the neighbors. I bit, you know, kids at school. So that was my big thing when I was a kid, was that I bit other kids.
Okay, but basically it's the same thing of getting physical, hitting, etc. I can imagine if you took somebody that got into fist fights that didn't think much of it with this kind of anger, it could get them in a lot of trouble and end them up in jail for a long, 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 long time. Okay, so we find that somebody has it. We see the symptoms. We take them to the right people. What kind of a program do they put you into to make sure that you can move through this? Because it can't be easy.
After I went to the psychiatrist and I was diagnosed, he actually gave me a prescription of Prozac. And within about 3 weeks, my anger started going away. And after 3 months, it was completely gone. I've been on Prozac for a year now, and I haven't been angry. I can't even remember the last time I was mad.
Okay, so effectively, the medication can be the answer in this particular case.
It can, and it was for me, and I had tried many things before I went to the psychiatrist. I tried meditation. I did emotional freedom technique. I started believing in God and analyzing my dreams. And, you know, I tried a lot of things before I actually went to the psychiatrist. And at that point, I was just on the phone with my counselor just crying, saying, please help me, please help me. You know, I'll do anything. Just tell me what to do and I'll do it.
And then that's when they recommended the Prozac.
Correct.
By the way, I think it's a good thing, so don't hear anything behind that. If that's what's going to do it, then that's exactly what you do. Now, for most people, will that work, or are other people, you know, with the different kind of symptoms, it's not really one shoe fits all, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, there are several antidepressants out there, and I know a lot of doctors and just people in general who are against. They are antidepressants. It was the one thing that worked for me that had a permanent effect. Everything else had a temporary effect, and I would just keep feeling like I was on an emotional roller coaster, just up and down and up and down and up and down. So this was the only thing that had a permanent effect with me, and I've been very fortunate. I haven't had hardly any side effects at all, and I know there's a lot of people choose to quit taking their antidepressants because they can't handle the side effects, and that was never a problem for me.
Robin, I've always been a believer in alternative medicine, but at the same time, allopathic medicine, the chemicals, there is a place for all of it. And if it's going to work with somebody, my goodness, you use it. I'm with you. I'm on your side. Yeah, Prozac's going to do it, then that's what you have. You do the Prozac.
Correct, yes. And I was told to stay on it for 18 months, and then I will slowly be tapered off it. And if I even feel like I'm going back to the way I was before and having angry thoughts and just, you know, tapes running through my head that are just negative and filled with a lot of anger, I'll just choose to go right back on Prozac.
Yeah, well, you know, and if you were going to be on it for the rest of your life, so what?
And that's the way I feel right now. If I need to be on it for, you know, the next 20 years and have a happy, angry, free life, I would rather do that than have another 40 years of living with the thymic disorder.
Oh, by the way, absolutely no question. I'm on your side of the table, 6,000% here. Let me ask you this. I picked the book up, Born Mad, and I read it page by page, cover by cover. What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before? What's my takeaway from this book?
To be determined and to never give up and to do whatever it takes to be happy. I started off the book through, you know, my temper tantrums as a child, but then when you get in the middle of the book and you come to the year 2008, I was actually very suicidal. And I didn't know what was wrong, and I had a great life. I mean, I had a great job and a wonderful husband and a beautiful home. I mean, I had no reason to be unhappy, and yet I was crying every day and didn't want to live. And so I finally, at the end of the book, you will find all the things that I tried to find out what was wrong with me, and then at the end, there's a happy ending.
there has to be. You're talking to me.
You'll go through living with me and being on medication and how that changed and how much better my life has gotten because of antidepressants.
And how much support did you get from your family? Because that's extremely important when somebody's going through something, they have that support group.
It is. My husband was there for me 100%. He never gave up. He's, you know, was the one that held me at night while I was crying and told me to stick in there, even when I wanted to leave and get a divorce. You know, he was there supporting me, you know, saying we can do this, hang in there. My family, my counselors, I mean, there are just so many people. When you get to that point where you're extremely depressed, you can't do it alone. You're going to have to lean on somebody. You're going to have to get support from someone or many people. And I was very lucky to have that support within my family and my friends and the professionals that were trying to help me.
Now, by the way, one of the things I wanted to talk about this, and I skipped over it. It's the a lot of people with the disorder suffers. They may also be drug or alcohol abusers too. Is that using it to hide it? Or does that expand it? Does that cause a problem that could be dangerous for someone?
Yes, there is a percentage of dysthymics who will have other dysfunctions. And I've only found one other book out there written by someone who actually has a disorder, and she just happened to be an alcoholic and had social phobia, which those things don't affect me at all. I was more the anger type. She said that she was accidentally given antidepressants when she was going through rehab, and that's how they discovered that she had dysthymic disorder. So her alcoholism was probably a symptom of the dysthymic disorder.
Oh, okay. So it's a reverse then. Okay, the alcoholism, the drugs, the whatever the case may be, is a symptom. You know, it'd be very interesting if somebody had the problem, alcoholism, the drug abuse, etc., for someone, for whatever professional that they went to really peel the layers off and get right down to what the problem is. Because somebody could stop drinking and all of a sudden you get what you got, and you've got the problem with the anger and the rest of it. So it's going to take very special counselors to be able to see through what appears to be.
Yes, it will. And with me, I was angry all the time, and I didn't realize that anger was a sign of depression. It actually can be a sign of depression, which doesn't really, you know, most people would say, well, being mad and being sad are totally different things. But anger can actually be a sign of many, many mental disorders and mental illnesses, not just the dysthymia, but there's a whole list of them. So yeah, you could mistake a symptom of dysthymic disorder for something else, you know, and without the right counselors and the right psychiatrist to come up with the correct diagnosis, it could just go undiagnosed.
Now, by the way, was there anybody in your family, that even aunts, uncles, cousins, whatever, brothers, sisters, anybody else have it?
Dysthymia can be genetic. I am the only one so far who has been diagnosed in my family. And again, that doesn't mean I am the only one in my family who has it. It just means I'm the only one that has been diagnosed. And several years ago in 2009, I had a second cousin who actually was 72 and in good health, and he decided he didn't want to live anymore, so he just starved himself to death.
So in essence,
and I don't know if he had dysthymia or not, but he could have.
Okay. Well, do you do talks in different groups?
Pardon?
Do you do talks to people? Do you stand in front of groups and talk to them about this? I mean, this is a message that has to go out there.
Yes, I would like to get it out there, and I will do speaking engagements to whatever group that is interested, basically. I will talk to anybody about this. I lived with it for over 40 years and didn't even know it existed. And I was in such mental agony that at this point in time, now that I feel better and I have all the mystery has been solved and I have the answers, I would love to, you know, give talks to church groups or book clubs or Rotary meetings and, you know, whatever you can think of.
No, I don't hear you. We're starting to run out of time now. Is there a website we can find you at?
You sure can. You can go to bornmad.org. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and if you want to order the book, you can go to bornmad.org or to balboapress.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Robin Wheeler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and my friends is, what is it? What is it? It's a ramp.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the